Yeah, it's your turn, Tim.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and get started? My name is Tim Terryberry. I'm with the ZIF.org Foundation. Parts of this work were also funded by the Mozilla Corporation, and I'm going to talk about the new Theora encoder, Thusnelda. Before I get started, I'd like to ask a general survey. How many of you did not see my 2008 LCA talk, either at LCA or on the web? All right, so most of you. That's okay. I'll just make sure to introduce what I'm going to talk about before I talk about it. But the basic outline of my talk, I'm going to go through a brief introduction on what the project was and what our goals were. And I'm going to talk about rate distortion optimization, which is an extremely important concept in video encoding. Then I'm going to go through a basic overview of the different pieces of the encoder and some of the improvements we made. And then I'm going to talk in detail about rate distortion optimization in the Thusnelda encoder. And finally, I'm going to conclude with a section on rate control, which is also extremely important. So, first point to make is Theora is an old codec. It's based on Onto's VP3 codec, which was developed in the late 90s, released publicly in 2000, and open sourced in 2001. So in 2002, they donated it to the ZIF.org Foundation with a patent grant so that everybody could use it. The capabilities of VP3 were very similar to other late 90s codecs, such as MPEG-4, the Advanced Simple Profile, and H.263. The only important difference is because it was open source and because they had the patent grant, anyone can use it for free. Now, we made some changes to VP3 before we released Theora, but fundamentally, it's the same codec. You can actually just change a few bits at the beginning of each frame to fix up the frame header and decode VP3 files with the Theora decoder. So a couple of the things we changed were we added some additional flexibility in the headers so you can specify different quantizers and codebooks, and formalized how to support non-multiple of 16 frame sizes. We did some minor technical fix-ups. There was a gotcha in the bitstream that would break for very large resolutions that we patched up. And we added support for a few other things. There are only really two new features. And the first one was support for different chroma subsampling. So the video data is split up into luma, which is basically grayscale, and chroma, which is two different color channels. And normally you encode the chroma channels at about half the resolution in each dimension as the luma channels because the eye is less sensitive to that. But we added support for additional subsampling, which will let you encode it at only half resolution in the horizontal dimension, and or you just encode it at full resolution. So you basically get better color support. The other feature we added was block level quantizer selection, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. We do not support 411, basically because Theora operates with 8x8 blocks in 16x16 macro blocks. And so to do 411, we would have had to break that structure, and that was just deemed too hard. So, even so, the encoder we released was not actually using any of these changes. So we were still using, until earlier this year, our stable release was still using the original VP3 encoder. We'd done some bug fixing, we'd done some cleanup to get it integrated into the OGG stack, but it was basically the same encoder. So we weren't using any of the flexibility to change quantizers and codebooks that we'd added to the headers. We weren't taking advantage of the block-level quantizers. And we basically weren't using anything that had been learned about video compression in the past 11 years. So I started a project in 2003 called Theora EXP. And this was just meant to be basically a playground for me. So it was highly experimental. We used it to test the new features we added, so we were really sure they worked before we added them to the bitstream. But it was never intended for widespread use. And basically, a number of the things that I experimented with in there didn't turn out to work so well. And so it gave fairly poor quality at high bit rates. Thusnelda was a new encoder project that we started in December 2007. The goal was to produce an actual production encoder, so something we could ship to you guys, and starting from the VP3 encoder instead of from scratch, which meant as we made each change, we could test it and verify that, yes, this is an improvement, instead of the Theora EXP approach was to throw a whole bunch of stuff together, and at the end, when stuff didn't work, it's like, well, I'm not really sure which part isn't working. And basically, the architecture had serious problems in Theora EXP. But we did pull in some of the good bits. So there's a faster, better motion search, which I'll talk about a little bit later, and statistics-driven mode decision, which I'll also discuss in more detail. And the goal here was to actually use some of our new features that we had added to the bitstream, and also to use modern video coding techniques. And the two I'm going to talk about today are rate distortion optimization and two-pass rate control. So I've mentioned rate distortion optimization a few times. Let's talk about what it actually is. So rate distortion optimization started from this constrained problem that people were trying to solve. We want to minimize the distortion that our lossy compression is going to introduce while fitting within a hard rate budget. So we can't take more than R bits, and we want to minimize the total amount of distortion we use within those R bits. So this is a constrained optimization problem, which in our context turns out to be very hard to solve. But we can transform that into an unconstrained problem. And this is using the technique of a Lagrange multiplier. So basically, we're going to minimize a single objective that combines both distortion and rate. And now you've got this factor lambda in there, which is the Lagrange multiplier, which says this is how much distortion I have to get rid of each time I add a bit. So if I'm going to spend a bit to encode something, it has to get rid of at least this much distortion, or it's not worth spending the bit. So the solution for the unconstrained problem is optimal for the constrained problem for some choice of lambda. Now, which choice of lambda depends on what your actual constraint is. And so now I have the problem, I have to pick lambda. But that turns out to be a much easier problem. In the worst case, you can just do a bisection search. You can try encoding with different lambdas. And if you bust your rate budget, you try again with a smaller lambda. This turns out to be much easier than trying to solve the constrained optimization problem. So this is the basic picture that you want to associate with rate distortion optimization. So what this diagram is trying to show is a bunch of different possible solutions in R&D space. So I've got R down along the x-axis and D up along the y-axis. And now if I look at a point on the convex hull here, if I take a step forward in R, as in I've added that much bit rate, then I have to go down in distortion by at least lambda. So you can imagine this line going through a point with a slope equal to negative lambda. And if my step does not go below that line, then I should not spend that bit. So that convex hull on the lower side there defines the different possible optimal solutions. And each one is optimal for a different lambda. So as I change lambda, you basically walk along this convex hull. Anything inside the convex hull is suboptimal no matter what my rate constraint is. So what I haven't talked about is how we measure distortion. And there's a number of different metrics, and we actually turn out to use all of them in different places in the encoder. So the first one is the sum of absolute differences. This just means that I take each pixel and I subtract it from the pixel that I'm in the frame I'm comparing it to, take the absolute value, sum them all up over a block, for example. There's also the sum of absolute transform differences. And in this case, I'm applying a transform to the pixels after I do the subtraction. Then I take the absolute value and sum them up. And the transform used here is the Hadamard transform, which is basically an extremely simplified version of the DCT. So I can do it without doing any multiplies. It's just addition and subtraction. And that turns out to be a good proxy for what the actual coefficients will look like when they're transformed by the encoder. Now, those two metrics are good for measuring differences between frames. So if I've taken a frame and I've subtracted off another frame, I'm left with a residual. And that's when you want to use these metrics. when I want to compare the final reconstructed frame, then we tend to use the sum of squared errors, which just, you do the subtraction, you square the residual, and you add it up. That actually turns out to be the same before or after applying the DCT, so I don't need to worry about a different version for the transform. And the reason you want to use different metrics, whether you're talking about a full reconstructed frame versus the difference between two frames, is they have different statistics. And so basically the first two metrics penalize outliers much less than the second metric. There are other possible metrics you can use. The sum of squared errors is known not to approximate the human visual system very well at all, but it turns out you can go a long way just using that metric. So, but an actual good metric that approximates the human visual system and that's cheap enough to use inside an encoder, which has to do, millions of these computations for every frame, that's still an area of active research. So now I want to go through the basic parts of the encoder. This is the block diagram. So we're going to start with input frames. They get fed into a motion estimation process. So we're going to try to figure out how things in the previous frame moved to get into the current frame. And use the previous frame compensated by this motion as a predictor for the current frame. So that eliminates large amounts of redundancy. Then we send the residuals between those predictions into the discrete cosine transform, which I'm not going to talk about in any detail, but basically that makes things easier to compress. The discrete cosine transform in itself doesn't actually offer any compression, though. So the lossy part of the compression is in this quantization and tokenization process. So we're going to actually take DCT coefficients that come out of this DCT process and chop off lower order bits and just throw them away. And finally, that gets fed into an entropy encoder, which is a lossless compression process. So that's just like, running something through a zip file. And then on the decoder, we basically reverse all of those same steps. And I'm not going to talk about the decoder in this presentation at all. If you want to know more about it, refer you to my previous presentation, which is online. So, on the input frames, I just wanted to do one more brief comment about chroma subsampling, and this is going to be the last time I'm going to talk about chroma in the entire presentation, just because it generally occupies so little of the bit rate, and you can apply so much distortion to chroma without people actually noticing that it's not terribly important. Unfortunately, this projector, these three images probably all look about the same to you, right? Well, on an LCD or a decent monitor, they'll look different. And the big difference is the 444, the example at the back there, which is not doing any subsampling, actually shows up as much brighter. And so this is basically the pathological worst case of why you don't want to subsample chroma, is thin green text on a black background. But even in that case, as you can see, with this projector system, you basically can't tell the difference. But if you're doing high-quality production or high-quality masters, you may want, or just doing screen captures where these sorts of things show up, then that might be a good time to use these formats. But as you can see, this is why most people just use 420, which does the subsampling in both directions. So we take the input frames, and we want to do motion estimation. The goal of motion estimation is to predict the current macro block, which is a 16 by 16 pixel block, from a reference frame. So we can use one or two reference frames, either the previous frame or the previous keyframe, offset by a motion vector. So that's just basically a pointer that says you should shift over the block you're going to predict from by this amount. So larger motion vectors require more bits to encode, which is important to know. And in Theora, they're limited to negative 15.5 pixels up to 15.5 pixels. And that's done in half pel units. So Theora does not support any finer resolution motion vector than that. Yes?
And you don't support large gross motions that cause blocks to shift to alternate blocks?
Right. We do, the question was, you don't support large gross motions, which cause blocks to shift to alternate block states. So the largest motion we support is 15 and a half pixels in any direction.
But fast pans become horrible
black. Right. This actually, in the vast majority of cases, you don't have motions that large. It becomes more of a problem as you get to HD, but you'll find even in a lot of commercial encoders, in formats that do support larger motion vectors, they don't actually search any wider than that. So it's a fairly common compromise. I wish it wasn't there, but...
Yeah, everybody does it and it looks horrible because some movies do it. Some movies have big pans and it looks horrible.
Right. So there are multiple different ways to do motion search. The general, if we wanted to search all of the possibilities, the approach is usually you search for a full PEL vector, so it's a whole number of pixels in the offset, and then refine that to half PEL. And the reason is that the error surface generally behaves very chaotically at the full PEL level, but when you're interpolating between pixel positions, then it behaves more reasonably. But if we wanted to do that, we'd require almost 1,000 SAD calculations per macro block, and there can be, you know, hundreds of macro blocks in a frame, to do this exhaustive search. So that takes forever. The VP3 encoder used a logarithmic search. So what they did is they would, you know, check offsets plus or minus 8 pixels in every direction, then they would do plus or minus 4 pixels from the best result, and plus or minus 2, and plus or minus 1. So that cuts 1,000 down to 33, which is a big improvement. Unfortunately, you're much less likely to find the best answer. And when they got a poor result, they fell back to doing full search, which meant on certain content, for example, when you're doing live streaming, you know, your CPU usage would be nice and low, and then it would hit something where all the motion search was failing. And so it was trying these full searches, and your encoder pipeline would fall way behind. Thus, Nelda uses a predictive search. So on average, this uses about 4 to 5 SAD operations. And what we're doing is predicting our motion vector from neighbors in both space and time. So we look, you know, assume constant velocity, assume constant acceleration. You generate a small set, and then you pick the best one and try to refine that one, basically using gradient descent. And on average, it takes about 4 to 5 SAD operations to compute a single motion vector. And even in the worst case, it's still better than VP3 was. So not only is it faster, it actually produces better motion fields. So you'll notice in Morpheus's black shirt here, the VP3 encoder has come up with a number of very large motion vectors, which are basically, if you're doing full search on an area that's relatively smooth and has no features, the point you find that's the best is essentially random. It could be almost anything. And if you're not, if we're using prediction for our motion search, then we're going to find a consistent answer for the whole region. And therefore, you won't find these large outliers like this. And it doesn't really matter which vector you've picked here, because they all give you something that's roughly a big flat black thing. So you can also see in the hands that you get much more consistent motion vectors. So motion vectors are actually encoded in macro blocks using these things called macro block modes. And so a macro block mode, basically, the mode tells you how you're going to encode the motion vector for that macro block. And there are a number of different possibilities, and they don't nearly cover all the possible ways you could do this. But we have to pick from this subset. So there are 8 of them. The intro one at the top basically says there's no motion information. I'm not trying to predict this block at all. Just code the actual block itself. And so that allows you to do encoding without referring to a previous reference frame. So this is what we use on keyframes. And it also allows you, for things where the prediction is just horrible, it's often better to just encode the thing without using prediction. Then there's a series of modes that all use the previous reference frame. And the only difference is how we encode the motion vector. So one, we can start with no motion vector. And that just copies the block straight from the previous frame with no offset. So that's great for still content or regions where you have a large uniform region. There's one that specifies an explicit motion vector. That's the MV one. Then there's two that can use a previous motion vector. So last uses the immediately preceding motion vector, and last two uses the one you specified two motion vectors ago. And each time you use one of those, it moves the motion vector in the stack. And finally, there's 4MV mode. So normally we specify one motion vector for the whole macro block, the 16 by 16 pixels. In 4MV mode, then we specify one for each 8 by 8 subblock. And so that helps you model more complicated motions better. Finally, there are two more modes which reference what VP3 calls the golden frame. So this is just the previous keyframe. And this only comes in two varieties, one where you don't specify a motion vector and one where you encode an explicit motion vector. Now, the important thing to note here is that unlike almost every other codec in existence, Theora doesn't take a whole lot of advantage of motion vector correlation. So we have last and last two, which we use to copy previous motion vectors directly. But the normal approach here is to take the previous motion vectors or a few neighboring motion vectors and predict the current one and then encode a residual, which that tends to work much better than what Theora is doing. So we have to be very careful on how we optimize the usage of macro block modes. So after we've done motion estimation and we've subtracted off our prediction from the current frame, each block is applied to a discrete cosine transform. So the basic idea of a discrete cosine transform is you take a bunch of pixel data for a region like this, and you apply a transform to it. And I'm not going to go into details about what that transform is or really how it works, but the kind of things you get out of it look like this, where you have a few large coefficients in the upper left-hand corner here, and most of the rest of the thing is zero. Sometimes you have little small coefficients, but this is a particularly contrived example, so they all come out to exactly zero. After we've transformed it, we then scan this block in a zigzag scanning order. And the idea here is we want to get long runs of zeros, because those are easy to compress. So that scanning transforms this 2D block into a 1D list. The first coefficient in that list is called the DC coefficient, just because its impulse response is constant. The other coefficients are called AC coefficients because they are alternating cosine curves. But if we wanted to implement an exact discrete cosine transform, it actually requires multiplication by these irrational constants like cosine of 3 pi over 8. And so the Theora spec defines an integer approximation, so you can actually implement it on a computer. But that adds some rounding errors. So it's not exactly the DCT. VP3 uses another integer approximation for the forward side. So that adds more rounding errors. So we've got an approximation feeding into another approximation. If you actually do look at the per pixel round trip squared error on that process that VP3 was using, you can get it as high as 9 with an average of 2.1. This is in pixel values. For some particular locations on the screen. And this was a good idea for VP3 because they weren't doing rate distortion optimization. And so what this basically did is it slightly lowered all these small coefficients and made them more likely to be zero. But now that we are doing explicit rate distortion optimization, it's a clear disadvantage, and it destroyed fine detail and texture even at very high rates. So we went back and re-engineered this. And basically what we did is we sat down with the inverse DCT, and for each step that was not exactly invertible, we tried to figure out something that would come as close to being the inverse of that as possible. And we were able to get the peak error down to 1 with an average of 0.01, so 3 orders of magnitude of improvement. I'm not sure exactly how well this comes out on this projector, but if you look at this presentation online, you can clearly see the difference between these two frames. But if you try to look at the texture in his shirt or in the creases of his face, you might be able to see the difference on this projector. But basically, using the new discrete cosine transform and also doing some tweaks to the quantizers, we were able to get a much more detailed picture at the same bitrate. So now the next step is quantization. So we have this list of coefficients that we've scanned in zigzag order, and we're going to divide them by a quantizer. And so basically, there are 64 different quantizers available. This is defined in the headers. We can set them to be anything we want. You can pick up to 3 of them to use in a single frame. So what we did in those NELDA is we picked a base quantizer, and then we picked one that was slightly larger and one that was slightly smaller. So that allows you to encode some portions of the frame in more detail and some portions of the frame in less detail and allocate bits in a better fashion. So the quantization step is the source of most of the loss in lossy compression. The other source of loss is the errors in the DCT in Theora. If you had a perfect DCT, this would be the only source of error. So, for example, if we take the list we had from the previous slide and just divide everything by 32, we result with a bunch of much smaller numbers, and these require fewer bits to encode. So the larger number we divide by, the fewer bits it requires to encode, and the more things get just truncated to zero. This introduces some error, so if you then multiply everything by 32, you can see you don't exactly get the same numbers you started with, but you get pretty close. Unfortunately, the DC coefficient, that's the first coefficient, is still rather large, because that's where most of the energy has gone. So in order to compress that better, we subtract a prediction from our neighbors. This is done after quantization. So once we've done quantization, we do a process that's fairly unique to Theora called tokenization. So Theora actually encodes all of these coefficients by translating them into tokens. So there are 4 different classes of tokens. The first class represents a single coefficient, so some non-zero coefficient. We call that a value token. There's also different tokens for a run of zeros. That's the second class. Finally, you have tokens for a combined zero run plus a small coefficient that appears at the end of the run. And so very often in a block, you'll have a whole bunch of zeros and then a one. And so that's what these help represent. And then finally, when there are no more non-zero coefficients in the block, you encode an EOB token for end of block token. And that's the fourth class. So there are actually 32 different types of tokens, and each one can encode different lengths of runs or different ranges of possible values. And some of them have extra bits stuck on the end, which give you tell you which specific value in the range is or how long the run was. So here's sort of an example tokenization. So the yellow tokens show up are the value tokens, and you can see, you know, most of the DC coefficients have a value associated with them. This is after DC predictions, so they're much smaller in value than the previous example. The zero runs show up in places where the value that appears at the end of the zero run is too large to encode it as a combo token. Those are the blue spaces. And the combo tokens generally show up as you can see how often that occurs. The interesting thing to note here is that EOB tokens actually say end the next n blocks, where n is some number, that have not already ended. As Theora scans tokens, it scans them along each zigzag index. So if I have an EOB block like this one up here, it says, you know, end the next several blocks, but I have combo tokens that have already pushed blocks below that past that point in the zigzag scanning order, which means it doesn't apply to them, because we already know those blocks didn't end. So that's another slight complication in this process. Finally, we take all of these tokens and all the motion vectors and all the macro block modes and apply entropy encoding. So the basic idea here is that for things like the coded block facts, when I would say, is this block coded at all? If it's not coded, it just gets copied from the previous frame. Those get stored with run length encoding, which works great when you're expecting long runs of the same value. And this is approximately true in the sense that you usually skip large portions of the same of a closer region in the frame. For macro block modes, motion vectors, and DCT tokens, we use these code books, and the idea of a code book is their variable length, and the more frequent values use fewer bits. So that's how we get our compression. There's for each of these things, there are several different code books to choose from, and so you basically just pick the one that gives you the smallest encoding for the current frame. So the code for all of this was newly ported from Theora EXP. It was, you know, unlike the VP3 code, which used to make pass after pass after pass over the frame data, this did everything in one pass. It was much simpler and used a whole lot less memory. But so now let's talk to the hard part, which is rate distortion optimization in Thesnelda. So in any real video codec, any decision you make is affected by lots of earlier decisions and can affect lots of later decisions. Now, if you can order all of these dependencies linearly or in a tree structure or something like that, you get nice dynamic programming solutions. You can find an optimal answer. Theora was not designed so that all the dependencies fell in a nice linear order. In truth, almost no video codec actually is. You can approximately do that, but most of the time there's something that doesn't quite work that way. One of the other big problems is that because there's multiple possible code books, that means we can't even tell what the real rate of something is going to be until we know what code book we're going to use. We don't know what code book we're going to use until we've encoded the whole frame, because then we can tell how much, which code book is the best for that frame. So that's something we're going to come back to. The short story is computing a global minimum of our rate distortion function requires exponential complexity. So we can obviously do it that fast, you know, if we just try all possible bit streams of length R. Then you can just pick the one with the smallest distortion. That's obviously going to take forever. So the idea is what real encoders do is they use this thing called operational rate distortion optimization. And what that term means is basically we're just going to optimize over a reasonably well-structured subset of possibilities and ignore all the possible other interactions. So the answer we're going to get is not going to be the global optimum. But we can get pretty close. So let's first talk about RDO applied to mode selection. So in the VP3 encoder, we checked these macro block modes. It would check a couple of modes, then it would look at the distortion. If the distortion was under a threshold, then it would stop. Otherwise, we'd start checking some more expensive modes, and eventually it would, you know, come up with the decision. But it only looked at distortion. It didn't look at the cost to code any of these modes. In Thesnelda, we do things a little bit differently. So there are only three modes that actually require motion vector search. That's the mode where we want to encode an explicit motion vector for the macro block, the one where we encode an explicit motion vector for all four subblocks, or the one where we want to encode a motion vector against the keyframe. Everything else, we already know what the motion vector is. There's no search involved. So we actually don't use rate distortion optimization in the search itself. We tried that, and it basically gave almost normal benefit, and it was slower. And the reason is because of Theora's specific structure for having last and last two motion vectors being the only way to encode a motion vector efficiently, the cost of explicitly coding a motion vector was usually amortized over several following blocks. So if we try to put that into the rate distortion optimization, then we're way overweighting the cost if we look only at the current block. So we don't do any rate distortion search. As a speed optimization, we only do that half-pel refinement step of the best mode. And for this, instead of using the sum of absolute differences, we use the sum of absolute transform differences. It's a slightly better metric. And because we just use it at this one step, we save computation. So our basic approach is we're going to, instead of only checking a few modes like VP3 did, because we have a much faster motion search, we can actually check all of the modes in less time and choose the best via this rate distortion criterion. So what we're doing right now is we make a greedy decision. So at the current macro block, we don't consider any future macro blocks. We just say, what's the best mode for this macro block, and use that one. In order to do that, we had to add a small bias for explicitly coding a motion vector. Otherwise, that almost never got chosen. which was suboptimal. But you can see the difference between the VP3 encoder and Thusnelda in this particular example is we use all of the possible modes much more frequently. So this is a scene from Big Bug Bunny, as the grass is getting blown over the field, and you can see the Thusnelda encoder uses the golden motion vector stuff to predict from the previous keyframe. We usually encode keyframes with a slightly higher quality because they get used as predictions for all of the subsequent frames. So now we're actually able to take advantage of that. And you can see on that one spot in the water where there's some complex rippling going on, it uses the four motion vector mode just to get the fine detailed motion predicted much better. And VP3 simply never even looked at these modes to see, to try to use them. So for each frame, as I said, you can have one of several different codebooks to code the macro block modes. So we don't really know what the rate for encoding a macro block in a given mode is going to be until we get to the end of the frame. The solution for this is we use this notion of opportunity cost. So there are only about 8 different codebooks you can use, and we compute the rate as the number of bits required to code all the modes up to n, you know, the current macro block, minus the number of bits required to code all the modes up to the previous macro block, using the best codebook in each case. So we can actually check all of those reasonably efficiently. We do the same thing for motion vectors. There's actually only 2 codebooks for motion vectors, so that's even faster. And it's not globally optimal, but it works reasonably well. The only downside is it requires evaluating the cost with every codebook, which for motion vectors and macro block modes is not too bad because there's only a few hundred per frame. The other problem we run into is that the distortion we're doing using a mode decision is based on sum of absolute transform differences. The distortion we're going to use for the quantization process is based on sum of squared errors. So we want to combine these in a single rate distortion optimization framework. We need some way to map the 2 distortion values in a comparable fashion. There are a number of different ways to do this. The approach taken by, say, the H.264 reference encoder is they replace lambda by the square root of lambda when they're using sum of absolute transform differences and just use straight lambda for these sum of squared errors. That's, you know, it works okay. There's an expensive way, which is we can actually go through with the transform and quantization process for all possible modes and look at the rate we get out and the actual distortion we get out at the end of the process. The problem here is that in Theora, you can't really know what the real rate's going to be until the whole frame is coded, again, because of this codebook selection problem. In Thusnelda, what we actually do is we use a big lookup table. And the idea is we take the mode type, so either an intra-mode or an inter-mode, so predicting from a frame or not predicting from a frame. We take the particular quantizer we're using, one of the 64 possible ones, and the sum of absolute transform differences for that block, in which we've quantized into some small number of bins. And you run that into a lookup table, and that table tells you the average rate and the average distortion after transformation and quantization. So we just collect a whole bunch of statistics over some set of video data. You say, if we were going to do the transform and quantization process, this is approximately what we get. And the actual error on any specific block is fairly high, but because we're making so many of these decisions, the global trend is roughly in the right area. And it actually gets us within about 4% of the optimal process, but it's orders of magnitude faster. So just to give you an example of what some of these lookup tables look like, the graph on the upper left here is a curve showing the average rate and the average distortion for a bunch of these different sum of absolute transform difference values. This is after transformation, after quantization, so this is measured at the end of the frame when we really know what the real rate is and everything. And you can see some interesting behavior here. In intra mode, it sort of steadily increases until you get to roughly a saturation point. And that's the quantization. Basically, as long as your error is initially below the quantization error, then you stay down you stay down there. If you're, as your error gets above the quantization error, then you sort of saturate at that point. Inter has a slightly different behavior, and that's that peak there that happens before we get to the end is where we're throwing away small coefficients, and that's is part of the rate distortion optimization process. Now, if we were just going to replace lambda with a different lambda, as say the square root of lambda, like H.264 did, this graph in the lower right here would be straight lines. As you can see, we don't really get straight lines out of that. But so for any given macro block mode, you can have four different states for each block. So we, as I said, we can pick one of three different quantizers, or we can skip the block. So we can now do rate distortion optimization on these decisions. Again, we use the same big sum of absolute transform difference lookup table, plus the cost to code these changes, so the cost to code to switch a quantizer between blocks or the cost to tell you that you're skipping a block. And it's cheaper to use the same quantizer or the same skip flag as the previous block because we're using run length encoding. So this creates a nice 1D chain of dependencies. And that, as I said before, gives you allows you to do an actual optimal solution using what's known as the Viterbi algorithm, presented by Viterbi in 1967. It actually came out of decoding radio signals. So the main idea of this algorithm is you construct something called a Viterbi trellis. And in each, so I've got a column here for each block, and each row is one of the possible states that block can be in. And now I'm going to say the cost of a block being in a given state is going to be equal to the cost of a previous state, whichever the previous state of a block was, plus the cost of transition to the new state. So now I'm going to, so block one, I can just evaluate what the costs are because there are no previous states. In block two, I say for all the possible previous states in block one, I figure out which one is the best. And I remember that one. And I do that for each of the possible states for block two. Now I'm going to go ahead and do that for block three. And again, I'm going to, for each possible state in block three, I check all the possible states that block two could have been in and figure out which one is the best. And once again, from block three to block four. And so that's going to be roughly order n squared, where n is the number of different states, because each state has to check every previous state in the previous block. So once I get to the end, I go through and say, well, what's the best cost of any state at the, in the last block? And I can follow these arrows backwards, and that tells me the optimal path through the trellis. And so that's the global optimum solution. So I could make that trellis actually span the entire frame. The problem is that I need a separate one of these for every macro block mode, because each one uses a different set of predictors, because they have a different motion vector associated with it. Which means when I transition between macro blocks, there's a huge number of possible transitions. So instead of just four, I have eight times four, which then gets squared. So I couldn't transform and quantize. I also couldn't transform and quantize a block until every macro block in the frame had been scanned, which means I have to defer most of my work until I've made a complete pass through all of the data, which means everything is out of cache and makes things run much slower. So instead, we limit this trellis to a single macro block. It's no longer a global optimum, but it gives reasonably good results. The only caveat is you have to disable adaptive quantizers. Basically, at very low bit rates, we use just one quantizer instead of three. So we can also apply rate distortion optimization to quantization and tokenization. So if we quantize with normal division, where you just divide and round, that minimizes the sum of squared errors, but does not minimize rate distortion optimization. So sometimes it's better to use an even smaller coefficient in for these various cases. The problem is we don't really know which rate to use. The solution is we assume that it's the same as the previous frame. We could try the same opportunity cost as before, but there's lots more coefficients in the frame, and we don't really know what the... And most of the time, the code book is the same. So this is basically, we construct a similar kind of trellis. There's some complications here in that we really... In that the zero runs in combo tokens don't advance you one column in the trellis. They can advance you several columns, which gives you an even more complex solution for the more complex solution for zero ones, which happen a lot. But it turns out we can skip most of those just because they aren't terribly important. All right. So now I want to talk about rate control. Basically, there's a number of new modes in the new encoder. The preferred mode is still constant quality, which we're currently approximating with constant quantizer. You should really be using this mode unless you need a specific size out, and there's no need to use two-pass with this yet. We may incorporate two-pass statistics in the future, but right now we're not. However, there's an unconstrained two-pass mode, which is new in Thusnelda, and this is what you should be using if you want to achieve a specific size. And the reason you don't want to use this for live streaming is basically you can have drastic bitrate spikes. So for that, we have a constrained buffer mode, which guarantees playback using a finite buffer in the client. You specify a delay in frames, which is basically how much to buffer, which defaults to the keyframe interval, and this is what you want to use for live streaming. This is closest to what the old VP3 encoder did, but it didn't actually give you any guarantees. You can also specify quality, which acts as a minimum, and that basically means you drop frames. And I don't want to go into too much detail on how that actually works, because we're running out of time, but if you look at buffer fullness over a clip here, you see with an unrestricted buffer, this varies a lot. This is over 2 megabytes, which would be about 30 seconds worth of buffering at this rate. For a restricted buffer, we can keep this in much smaller intervals, and the tighter restrictions and tighter intervals. If you compare all of the quality of all of these frames, you'll see the blue thing in the middle is our two-pass mode, and that stays fairly consistent except for that one tough scene in the middle. But the old VP3 encoder stays much lower than all of them, and the other ones vary up and down. So sometimes they do a little bit better, sometimes they do much worse. And people generally remember the quality of the worst frame in your encoding, so you want to be using two-passes if at all possible. This is final conclusion. The new encoder performs much better, so we do an overall quality metric. You can see during the development process, this has gone up and up and up. There's lots of future work to do, so there's plenty of things we still haven't experimented with. We can take much better advantage of adaptive quantization. We haven't looked at spatial noise sampling. We can make some of the decisions we had were greedy before less greedy, basically doing less operational rate distortion optimization and more real rate distortion optimization. And we also have plenty of things we can play around with quantars and codebooks. So are there any questions?
One question, I think. At a number of places, you mentioned where you kind of have optimized by doing something because it's computationally possible within a reasonable time. Do you have an implementation that will, you know, run for days but give a better result using, you know, the ideal thing if you had unlimited CPU?
We don't have anything that's released in production that way. We've done some things with very slow testing. So, for example, in some cases we've checked with a single block against all 64 quantizers, you know, just to make sure that we have the statistics right so we know we're getting close to optimal. But, yeah, nothing like that has been released in a public forum. There is an API for basically specifying I want you to operate slowly and I want you to operate quickly, you know, with a quality trade-off in between. We haven't done a lot with that yet. It's there, you can use it, and it gives you a small trade-off right now. But, yeah, that's certainly something we want to look at more in the future.
Whence came Thusnelda? Where's the name?
So the name actually came from Monty. And I'm actually blanking on what the actual inside joke was there.
This is a horrible, horrible question, and I apologise in advance. Given that the current benchmark for, I guess, mid-range codecs, if you don't care about freedom, is probably still H.264, how close do you think we're going to get in terms of the future improvements that are likely to come in 1.2 and future development from there?
Well, so the real question there is, what encoder are you comparing against? And there are lots of different possible encoders. So we're already very close to what YouTube was using last summer, for example. And we posted comparison pages that showed there was basically no discernible difference. And some people even said they preferred ours.
I remember saying that. I'm probably thinking more of a comparison against probably the way most people run, say, X.264.
Right. So, yeah. So if you compare our encoder against X.264, we're probably never going to get to the same bit rate or the same quality at a given bit rate. I'd roughly guess we could get between, right now we're probably within around 50%. We could probably get between 30 or 40%, depends on the material somewhat. That's just a rough estimate and depends on the development of both our development and how much X.264 improves as well.
Would there be any easy wins if you could break the file format?
Yes. The problem is that we would lose all of the freedom of advantages in that all of the work we've done to verify that this thing really doesn't infringe other people's patents and all the buy-in we have with other third parties, that we would lose. That's ultimately something we want to do. So I want to create a next-generation codec that can take advantage of some of these things. But that's going to be a longer process. The goal of Fresnelda was really to get something out that could be used in HTML5 today. And so, maybe 5-10 years from now, we can have something much better, but it's not going to happen tomorrow.
I've actually got one related to that. Because, you were saying that the decoder had modes in it that the encoder, old encoder, wasn't using at all. The format, different quantizers and different macro block, or whatever it was, there were things that old encoder wasn't using that were possible. And did actually the encoder, the decoder, recognize those, or was it just untested?
I'm sorry, can you hold the microphone a little closer? I couldn't hear.
I'll come and talk to you. The new encoder uses parts of the file format that weren't used by the old encoder, and did the decoder just all the time just kind of silently try to decode those things that it never saw, or does the decoder have to be?
So the decoder that we had been shipping since at least beta 8 actually alpha 8 actually supported all of the features even though we weren't using them. So the new features that the new encoder actually uses have been supported for years. And it's basically a matter of, all that software that has shipped previously just works. That's not true for necessarily for third-party decoders, such as FFmpeg had lots of problems. Right. But that's been patched now, and I believe most of those are resolved.
I think what Douglas was trying to say, does your decoder try to do operations in the absence of information, or can it skip out on doing work because the information wasn't in there with the older encoder?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.